The reading today is Esther, chapters 3 and 4. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was
filled with fury.
But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to
destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus.
In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots, before Haman day after day. And they cast it month after month, till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus,
"There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries."
So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps, and to the governors over all the provinces, and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script, and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus, and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces, with instruction to
destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods.
A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and command her to go to the king and to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say,
"All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days.
And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther,
"Do you not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews? For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?"
Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai,
"Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish."
Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him.
Thanks to our readers, the latest adventures of Esther. And it's really good to have you with us. Welcome if you are new with us, especially, or if you're in town for the bank holiday. It's really great that you've been able to join us. When I was 13 years old, my family moved down from Scotland to England, and I remember it very well. I remember some of my mum's friends, when they heard the news that we were having to move south, saying to us very earnestly, "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that." It really was as if there had been a death in the family for some Scottish people. The thought of having to live in England is that level of a tragedy. And it wasn't much fun at first, to be honest, as a teenager, being the different one with the funny accent. I've tried to tone it down over the years. I tried to take up cricket to fit in. That didn't go too well. And I even gave up wearing my kilt to school eventually. But my experience of being a stranger in a foreign land is, I guess, nothing compared to the regular experience that lots of you guys go through, having to come to terms with and live with all the weirdnesses of our British culture. So the quality of the food here, there's the way that us Brits tend not to say what we're really thinking. Have you noticed the way we do that? And then there's navigating things down on the London Underground and all the weird etiquette involved with that. Our Piccadilly line, you might know, joins up with Heathrow Airport. And you see a lot of people coming through our way who look like they've just arrived in town with all of their bags, standing on the escalators on the right-hand side and standing on the left-hand side with all of their bags. That is not the way to make friends with the commuters on the London Underground. Being a foreigner in exile, you might say, it can create some funny moments and misunderstandings. But being the different one can also feel quite painful and alienating as well. Welcome to life as part of the people of God. The New Testament explicitly calls Christians exiles. And that, I think, is one of the reasons that this book, Esther, resonates and is a book for our times. It's one of the reasons why I was so keen that we would receive the blessing of hearing God speak to us through this particular Bible book. Because Esther, you see, she didn't live in the homeland. She didn't live in Jerusalem, the home of the temple and God's glory, the place full of miracles and victories and prophets. Esther lived in pagan Persia, where kings thought they were the gods, and where the real God was never mentioned at all. She lived in exile. Thanks for some of the chats I had with some of you after last week's talk. You feel slightly vulnerable as the preacher when you get up and say things like, "Doesn't it feel like God is hidden and distant a lot of the time. You're slightly worrying up here as you say that, that everyone else is thinking, no, Kev, that's only you. Thanks for reassuring me that that kind of anxiety is a normal thing. And we really want to be honest with each other at Euston Church about what the Christian life is like, about what's normal. Esther is a book for the days when it feels difficult to believe that God is at work, or even there at all. It's for the days when just the sheer weight and amount of unbelief going on in your life around you starts to chip away at your own faith. You will have days like that. Some of you know all about them. If you're a new Christian, if you're looking into Jesus, we're so glad you are. We long unashamedly that you will become a Christian. But we want to be honest with you about what you would be getting into. I guess you've probably noticed that London is not the capital city of the kingdom of God. You will often feel displaced in this world, because if you're a Christian, this is not your home. But don't despair. Esther is a precious book for exiles like us. Just before we dive in, I want to say something. This is, I guess, a little bit of an excursus, just about applying the Old Testament to our lives generally. We never look at the Bible just for interest or for fun. The book of Esther is interesting and it's fun. But we want to be changed people. We long that this encounter with God's word will make us more mature in our knowledge and our love for him. And because the Old Testament is unfamiliar and speaks to different periods in the history of God's plan, it can be quite confusing sometimes trying to work out exactly how what's going on in the story would apply to our lives. But that's something we can get better at, and we'll need to at Euston, because over the summer we're going to be spending a lot of time in the Psalms. We'll say more about that in a few weeks. And then starting in September, we're going to spend the whole of the next academic year in midweek in the Old Testament, in 1 and 2 Samuel. So I really hope and pray that us being able and equipped to handle the Old Testament well will be something that we grow in together as a church family. And that's partly why I put on the inside of your sheet some tips on that. Someone said that these handouts are getting scarier and scarier looking. Sorry about that. It's the right-hand column in the middle. It's not really to read now. It's something I hope you'll find useful in your own times in the Old Testament, and a bit of a how-to guide for us as we seek to apply it together. We're going to have a question time in 2 weeks. If you want to ask questions about any of this, feel free to. The headline really that I'm trying to get at on that sheet is, think what's it saying about God, and think how does it fit into the big Bible story. Generally think about those things before you think, who is the person in this story who I can get a little lesson from about my life? See, it might be that the application is about changing your thinking. It might be that there's an example to follow or avoid. But again, we need to be careful. So I put on the first bit of the sheet there some potential applications for last week's passage that you might want to avoid. So year-long visits to the beauty salon was not the main application of we should be a bit like Esther. And that one might be dead obvious, but some of the ways we might go wrong might feel a bit more difficult to spot. And the key thing that I want you to take away from that sheet, and it's what the questions at the bottom right hand are getting to, is really just use the Bible. Let the Bible be your commentary on the Old Testament. It will tell you who the characters are, what the big themes mean. It will tell you it can't mean that because that would contradict something God says later on. Let the whole Bible be your commentary as you seek to work your way around a passage of the Old Testament. And if that sounds a bit nerdy stuff, why are we talking about all of that? Guys, it really, really matters, because we can go quite easily, quite wildly wrong, actually, in our application of the Old Testament. So you could have thought from last week, well, Esther made some ethical compromises, it seemed. Maybe God thinks that's all right if you get into a position then where he could use you. Or this line that comes up in verse 15 of chapter 4. It might be the only verse of Esther that you've heard quoted. People love quoting this bit, "for such a time as this." And you could, well, you could use that to justify any situation that you're in a compromised world. So, you know, here I am at this strip club. Maybe God wants me to be here for such a time as this. Really? Or, you know, maybe God wants me to be out here getting drunk with my friends for such a time as this. We need to be careful. And if they sound, you know, crazy exaggerations, those are exactly the kind of misguided routes that people sometimes go down when applying the Old Testament. We want to protect ourselves. We want to equip you to be able to use the Bible and join it up to your life much more carefully and much more excitingly, actually, than that. Well, that's the end of the excursus. Three things, and if you time how long the talk is going to be by how much space there is on the points, it won't work today, so don't get scared that the first point is quite long, because points 2 and 3 will be much shorter. The first and the main thing from here really is about powerful people and their normal relationship with God's people who are in exile. And this was me asking the questions at the bottom of the sheet as I was thinking, how do these principles apply to this passage? So where does this passage fit into the unfolding Bible story? It's exile, we've said that. Does this passage develop any big Bible themes? Well, as well as exile, I think the big theme that's developed here is the theme of the people of God, and particularly the people of God under oppression. I'm going to show us in a minute why that theme partly bubbles up from actually the narrative itself and links into places where that is the theme in other parts of the Bible. But if you weren't here last week, previously on Esther, the king got drunk and fired his wife. Esther became queen after winning a talent show called The Sex Factor. Her cousin Mordecai the Jew lurks in the shadows. And here we are in 3 verse 1, meeting one final key character for this book. 3 verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. If you were here last week, you might think, shouldn't Esther's cousin Mordecai get the job? The last thing he did in chapter 2 was foiled a plan to kill the king. Typical, isn't it? You do the right thing at work, someone else gets the promotion. Haman the Agagite, and you just know from his name, don't you, that he's going to be a baddie. Hi, I'm Haman, I'm an Agagite. I'm scared already. And we're going to say more as we go on in this book about the way that Esther is read and celebrated within the Jewish communities. It gets acted out in a fun way. Sometimes, like, if you know what the British genre of pantomime is, a bit like that, or a bit like a puppet show that involves a bit of audience participation. So they literally do boo during these readings when the character of Haman comes onto the stage. Even the mention of his name is meant to be drowned out by boos and hisses and other stamping and noises. So we're going to do this just once so that we really get the feel for how Esther should be read. So I'm going to read 3 verse 1. Do you know what you have to do? The audience participation bit? After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite. Well done, good, quite a variety as well. Someone said to me this morning, we've been waiting for a while to get the chance to boo at one of your sermons, which I thought was a little bit rude. And let's not do that again, otherwise we'll be here for the whole of the bank holiday weekend. But that's how you're meant to feel as you hear his name read out. And it's a bit almost irreverent, isn't it? Did that feel a bit shocking? Like when the Bible was being read in the middle of the sermon? And we'll see as we get to the end of the book why that kind of jovial tone is deemed appropriate for the book of Esther. But we had this idea last week, introduced the idea that actually one of the big ways that God protects his people from fearing the world's power too much is by helping us to laugh and mock those powers. And if ever there was a worldly power to be feared, Haman is your man. The problems began when Esther's cousin Mordecai refused to pay homage to Haman. Mordecai seems to work for the government. Everyone in the citadel of Susa does. He's one of the king's servants, verse 2 says of chapter 3. He's at the king's gate, verse 2. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai didn't bow down or pay homage. He's a Jew. He's got involved, though, in this godless structure and system, as all God's people have to do when we live in exile. We have to get involved to some extent in the world. It's right that we do get involved. But God's faithful people will always draw the line somewhere about what they get involved with in exile. There'll always be things where the culture around us will do something that God's people will have to refuse to do. And you might rightly, fairly question Mordecai suddenly feeling convicted about having to draw these lines. You know, maybe you think just having to salute the prime minister is not such a big deal compared to allowing your cousin to enter the sex factor. But he decides to draw the line when it comes to not bowing to Haman. And as it always does for God's people when they refuse to join in, it makes life a little bit awkward. Verse 5, Haman goes berserk. He really goes nuts. Verse 5. Then the king's servants who were, verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai didn't bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. It's always the little things in life that wind you up, isn't it? So it's great being the prime minister of Persia. I arrive at the palace every morning, get out of the stretched limo onto the red carpet. They all bow at me dutifully, except this one Jew who just stands there saying, I ain't bowing. Why is he ruining my life? Verse 6. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now, we've got used to over-the-top reactions from the big wigs of Persia. But this is ridiculous, isn't it? Imagine Vijay offends you in a small way. Maybe he calls you Bruce or Sheila in that way that Australian people do. And you decide that's so annoying that you're going to destroy all Australians everywhere. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Well, this is the serious plan. He doesn't just kind of get over it after he goes to the pub or has a night's sleep. He persuades the king, verse 9. The king completely irresponsibly gives Haman the nuclear codes, if you like. And it just gets this feeling all the way through. The Persian government was very well-oiled, very administratively slick machine. Administratively slick when it came to planning a Holocaust. That's what verse 13 is, see? Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day. And actually this story drives us to spot the fact that this hatred towards God's people from Haman is part of a bigger story. Haman the Agagite, it tells us several times in Esther. And I put on the timeline's the same as last week of the Bible story. The only different thing is I've added in a few incidents between the Israelites and the Agagites and their family. So the one at the bottom is about Haman and Mordecai. Way back, though, there was a guy called Agag himself. He was an Amalekite, and he had a big bust-up with Israel. Israel was meant to totally destroy him, and they didn't, actually, at the time. But even going further back than that, the Amalekites, who the Agagites were part of, were the first people who persecuted and tried to destroy Israel when they were rescued out of Egypt. And Moses predicted back then there'll always be conflict between Israel and this tribe. Another detail in the text that drives us to the bigger picture is the date of this pronouncement of the future Holocaust. And you'd have to be a real Exodus nerd, basically, to spot this. But verse 12, the date when the genocide is planned for, 3 verse 12, the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and that's when this edict was commanded. 13th day of the first month is the eve of the celebration of Passover. It's Passover Eve. And that's just some sort of tragic irony, isn't it? As God's people prepare to celebrate their big rescue from oppression, they're about to be plunged into another big oppression. See, to be God's people, wherever you put the pin in the Bible timeline, usually it has a sniff of danger to be part of the people of God. And it's a theme that carries on in the New Testament. Jesus warns his people they will be hated, sometimes by the world. Tells them to expect to be hauled up before governors and kings. Satan is the chief perpetrator of the hostility. But sometimes his purposes are state-sponsored. Think Roman Empire in the first 300 years AD. Think China from 1800 onwards. Think Russia in the 20th century. Think North Korea today. Open Doors are one of the organizations who track the persecution of Christians around the world. They say North Korea is the most dangerous place in the world to be a Christian. The state has an iron grip on its citizens, and Christians are considered enemies of the state. Thousands of believers are incarcerated in prison camps in North Korea this evening. The abuses of Pakistan's blasphemy laws are a big source of persecution. Christians must always be careful because these laws can result in allegations being raised just purely to settle individual scores. Churches can still meet, but they sometimes get bombed, as you might have heard happened on a church there a few weeks ago. And the state treats Christians as second-class citizens. One girl was told, "You are clever, you are gifted, but you're a Christian, so you will become a sweeper." The government in Somalia is barely functional, they say, at the national level. It leads to the thing being run by tribes and a system that institutionally persecutes Christians. At least 75 Christians arrested last year in Somalia, in several cases abused, threatened, and executed. I wonder if you've thought about this. If you're a Christian, there are people out there who want to kill you. It's just an accident of geography that means they happen to not be able to get their hands on you today. And if that sounds overdramatic, of course it isn't always that way. Lots of normal people love and admire Christians. Maybe they did in Susa. Maybe that was why the citizens were so confused. Why are we killing the Jews? The behavior here is extreme against God's people. But I wonder if you notice what caused the provocation. It's something very ordinary that every Christian should be able to connect with. It's in 3 verse 8. I wonder if you spotted it. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they don't keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. He's exaggerating. Mordecai just saved the king's life in the previous reading. But he's right when he identifies that God's people are different. They can't be trusted to give their full allegiance. And lots of us will have experience of how that then feels at the low grade kind of level. The family, the friendship group, the company doesn't have your full allegiance in the same way if you're one of the different ones. And that leads to all kinds of accusations, doesn't it? Disloyalty, misunderstandings, and sometimes completely irrational responses. We need to not be naive. This is a normal part of God's people in exile. And sometimes in some places, it does mean the authorities are out to get you. Doesn't mean that for us in this country at the moment, but it does for some of us in the places we'll go back to. Rob was reminding us this morning that Natasha from Belarus, who was part of our church family for a couple of years, her pastor was threatened with prison there in Belarus last year. But even here in Britain, we mustn't be surprised where our loyalties conflict with the loyalties that the culture around us would want us to have. Intolerance comes in a variety of forms. So we shouldn't be surprised that Camden Council down the road are on a mission to snuff out religious education from the Camden schools. Some of you work in the public sector. It can often feel particularly threatening in the state sector if you work in a school or a hospital where there is a lot of pressure for Christians not to say or only to say certain things. Sometimes in companies, actually what's called a diversity policy can be a cloak for something that says you can have your Christian club, but don't talk to them or try and convert anyone else in the office. And who knows what's next in a culture that's walking away from a heritage of Bible faith and ethics. We're very blessed. We need to be clear that we don't live in North Korea. We have so many freedoms. We have the freedom to vote in this country this week. You don't have to vote as a Christian. It's not compulsory, but it is something you might choose to exercise. And just so we're clear, we don't have a particular party line at Euston Church. Someone told me earlier that they think it's illegal for a clergyman to suggest who people should vote for. So there you go. I'm not going to... Maybe I should actually see what happens if I get arrested. But don't, the red is not... This is not a sort of subliminal sign or anything like that. But do, if you want to vote, it's great to think carefully about how you can encourage the people in power to care about justice and values that God thinks are important. It's great if you get opportunities to pressurize them, encourage them strongly in that way. But don't pin your hopes on any of them protecting Christian values and freedoms. Oh, there have been Christian governments sometimes in history. Great Christian political individuals who God has used in this country and way back to the Bible. Think Joseph or Daniel or Esther, what we'll see her able to do next week. But we're not promised that we'll be able to build Jerusalem, if you like, through the political structures and systems. The only thing we're promised, actually, is that at some point God's people will come into conflict with them. It's just a normal part of life in exile. We don't live in Jerusalem. We live in Persia. But we don't despair. Because much more briefly, our second point is that deliverance will rise. This was me in my preparation asking the question, what do we learn about God in this passage? And you might think nothing, he's not mentioned. He never speaks. Lots more about him in next week's passage and his big plan to deliver a people. But a few lucky incidental details emerge. I wonder if you noticed how Haman decided when he was going to eliminate the Jews. Did you spot this in verse 7? It sounds a bit weird. The first month, the 12th year, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman day after day. This is, seems to be how they decided when to do stuff. So I don't know, have you seen one of those magic eight balls? I think it's an American thing. You shake it and it comes up with different kind of things that it tells you that you might want to do. So you're thinking, should I ask her out? And you shake it and it comes up with ask again later. And you think, no, I don't want to ask again later. You shake it again. Should I ask her out? Outlook not promising. Oh, okay, I'm not going to ask her out. And I've seen people actually make decisions based on that kind of response from an eight ball. And why not? If you don't believe in God's sovereignty, you might as well base your beliefs on something. And in Persia, they seem to decide when to do things, a bit like the draw for the FA Cup. So what day shall we exterminate the Jews? Stick your hand into the bag. Okay, we'll do it on that date. Just so happens that that date buys them time, the Jews. It's almost a year before that date will arise. And it just so happens that in the meantime, a queen has come to power who might be able to lobby the king directly. And it just so happens, as we said earlier, the announcement of the Holocaust is made on the eve of Passover. Is that just a tragic irony? Or is that also the source of hope? God, who rescued his covenant people, wouldn't allow all of them to be destroyed, would he? Well, Mordecai doesn't believe so. Look at 4 verse 13. This is his message to Esther in chapter 4. Do not think to yourself in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. He doesn't know what's going to happen or what it will mean for particular individuals in the meantime, whether they'll survive or not. He's not even sure that Esther will be able to help, but he is sure that deliverance will come. Doesn't quote chapter and verse, doesn't have a new prophecy. It's just suggestive. And remember we said last week, that's the way the book of Esther works. We don't get a running commentary in our lives about exactly how God's plan is working out. But do you have anything to draw on if you're God's people in exile? Do you have a track record to look back on? Or promises that you might bring to mind at this time? Must be very difficult, mustn't it, in one of those camps in North Korea tonight as a Christian to believe that God has a plan to sort it all out. Or when your church has just been exploded in Pakistan. Or even in politically correct Britain, where it seems that political correctness reigns over everything you're allowed to say. Oh, there might not be miracles and voices, but God's people are never just hostages to blind fate and human powers. Relief and deliverance will rise. We've actually got more evidence than Mordecai that that's true. We have better and bigger promises. Do you know the verse from Romans that says that in all things God is at work for the good of those who love him? There isn't always an Esther to come and sort things out. Come back next week to see how this one is resolved. But a plan to turn mourning into joy and fasting into feasting is always God's plan for his people. And so very finally, in the meantime, if you live in the middle of the story, is there any example to draw here from what the characters do? Well, actually, the main application that we are to follow comes in the very last part of Esther. Come in 2 weeks' time for that. But I think, yeah, the way Mordecai sees it, he really seems to want to identify with all the Jewish people at the start of chapter 4. Esther really identifies with all of the Jewish nation at the end. And the more you see the normal people of God in a passage, the more likely they are the ones that we are meant to be like. And what are the people of God doing here? Well, the tone, did you see verse 3 of chapter 4? It's all weeping and lamenting and mourning. See, Mordecai's confidence that this will all work out in the end doesn't mean that life in the middle of the story is less painful feeling. And we need to be very clear about that. Christians have mighty promises about the future, but we mustn't be triumphalist or pretend it doesn't feel hard now. And if God's people around us are suffering deeply in persecution, the right thing is to mourn with those who mourn, weep with those who weep. There is a real sense of togetherness here. Did you notice the way that it is a real communal lamenting among the people of God? I was just quite challenged. I wonder how much do we really join with God's suffering people around the world. Sometimes it's just laziness. We don't know the information or bother to find out how people are suffering or how we could help, pray for them or get involved. But sometimes maybe it's actually fear that if we got too involved with people who are being persecuted, we might be persecuted as well. And that's where the lesson, I think, of the courageous faith on display here is just very inspiring. Often is that persecution emboldens God's people, and it seems that way for Esther and Mordecai. They both seem like they're on a journey from where they were last week to increasing boldness, increasingly publicly God's people, and increasingly willing to be brave. So Esther at the end of verse 16, "I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." We're saying, go Esther, it's great, gutsy stuff. But they don't know what's going to happen at this stage, remember? They don't know whether Esther can help. And we shouldn't pretend that we know exactly how God's plan to save his people will work out. But if you believe there's a hidden hand behind it all, if you believe that every time is an appointed time from him, and if you know that deliverance will rise, then it does release you to be very, very bold. So can I ask us as we finish, obviously we don't live in North Korea, but how will you publicly show that you are one of the different ones this week? How will your different loyalties and allegiances emerge in the detail of your life? Will you have opportunities to be bold? It's risky to be bold in exile, even when you live in fairly comfortable London. Sometimes means putting things on the line, up to and including your life. But it's not crazy to be bold in that way when you know that deliverance will rise. And who knows, in times like Esther's, who knows in times such as this, how the hidden hand of God might choose to use his courageous people very mightily.